Hello, and welcome to Profiles, a program that introduces to WFIU listeners interesting people from Indiana, the United States, and the world. I'm Owen Johnson. Our guest on this occasion is CBS correspondent Steve Croft, a veteran reporter on the award-winning 60 Minutes. He's won 3 Peabody Awards and 11 Emmys, including one for Lifetime Achievement. Steve, welcome to Profiles.
My pleasure, Owen.
How did you get interested in journalism? And it must have been early because you were already editor of the high school newspaper, the Red and the Blue at Kokomo.
Well, I wasn't the editor. I wrote some stories for them. I was always good in English, and I was always sort of interested in being in newspapers. My first job was delivering the Kokomo Tribune, but a friend of mine and I used to put out a little newspaper in Kokomo that we distributed to our neighbors when we were in grade school. I finally got into it sort of a back door. I decided in high school I wanted to write television commercials. It was the 1960s, the early 1960s, and the heyday of Madison Avenue, the same sort of period that was that is featured in the show Mad Men. And it was very glamorous, and the commercials were incredible, incredibly creative. And so I went off to Syracuse University with the idea of doing that, and I took a lot of broadcast courses. My major was called radio and television at the time, communications later. And I developed a skill set, and I got drafted in 1968 sent off to the Army and to Vietnam, and the journalism courses that I'd taken at Syracuse became sort of my survival skill, and ended up with a job with Stars and Stripes, and went to the Defense Information School at Fort Harrison in Indianapolis before that. And I got back from Vietnam and decided that I did not want to write television commercials anymore, and that I was totally hooked on journalism and wanted to be a network correspondent.
Of course, I have to ask you why you chose Syracuse and not Indiana.
It's actually a complicated decision, but my family moved from Kokomo to New York when I was 16, in the beginning of my junior year in high school. And Syracuse was, in many ways, the only Big Ten-like school in the Northeast. There were a couple of others, Boston College and Penn State, and had football teams, basketball teams. And the advantages of going to IU at that point had been diminished because I was an out-of-state student, and I think it was even more expensive to go to IU than to Syracuse. Plus, my father graduated from Purdue. So I think I could have gotten away with Notre Dame, but I don't think I could have gotten away with Indiana.
Your experience in Vietnam is one that many of your generation shared. What did you gain from that experience?
I would say that that all of the things that I gained were on the professional side. I certainly don't think on a personal side. I got very much out of it, and probably a lot of baggage that I may still carry. But I got there, and I thought that I would try and make the best of the situation, and was able to get a job first in the 25th Division's Information Office on the headquarters staff, and I was doing stuff for Armed Forces Network and about the 25th Infantry Division. And I just kind of approached it like a job. It was was going to be my first job in journalism. And I got the opportunity to go to Stars and Stripes some months later, which was really an excellent newspaper. Most of the people on the staff were people like myself, many of whom were working for the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal before they got drafted.
And one of your current fellow staff members, Andy Rooney worked for Stars and Stripes
in
years ago.
During World War II. So I learned about journalism from working with people who had actually been out in the world and had jobs doing it. I learned about covering wars, I think, which is still, I find, very useful in doing stories in Afghanistan and Iraq, and knowing the difficulties of fighting insurgencies in particular. And I think I grew up. It made me grow up in a way that I'd never that I hadn't up until that point. And so I took away a lot of positive things from it that have helped me later in my career. But I'm not a big advocate in sending people off to fight wars that aren't absolutely necessary.
You were there at the time when the attitude of GIs was beginning to shift. Did you detect that? Did you feel that?
Oh, absolutely. I was there. I got there in January of 1970, and it was a very difficult time to be there in terms of morale. It was when President Nixon had begun withdrawing troops, and the people that were still there, the message was clear that we weren't going to stay and fight and win this war. We were going to withdraw, and that makes it much more difficult for people to be willing to go out and potentially sacrifice their lives for something, a decision that's already been made. And it was at a time when there were lots of fraggings, where servicemen would actually murder their commanding officers. And you were dealing with a situation not like today in Iraq and Afghanistan, where people enlisted and signed up to do this. You were dealing with people who had been drafted into it. And I think that's one of the reasons why there was this push to go to an all-volunteer army afterwards, because it was not – the 1970, 1971 were not good years for the U.S. Army, and because there was so much dissension within the ranks. And when I was at Stars and Stripes, we broke a story that 10% of the people that were leaving Vietnam to go home had some addiction to heroin. The drug problem got to be pretty serious.
Did you have any difficulties in breaking a story like that in the paper?
Surprisingly not. I think there were some high-level discussions, but it was an important story, and I don't think that there was – it was the kind of story that impacted the military, and I think they were glad to see – they were glad to see it out there. And I don't think it would have gotten out anyway somewhere.
How did you get your first job in broadcasting when you got back to the States?
Well, I came back in May of 1971, and I still had a couple of courses to complete at Syracuse to get my degree. And because back then you only had 4 years of to complete your degree, and if you didn't, then you became 1A immediately. So I finished up a couple of courses at Syracuse and didn't feel much like going immediately into the job market. And at the time, if you were a returning Vietnam vet, you got $75 a week unemployment, which was still a fair amount of money. So I spent about 4 or 5 months hanging out with friends of mine at the on campus, and I had to go to the unemployment office every week to justify and be asked these questions: have you looked for work? Have you applied for work? Have you refused work? And you had to go out if somebody gave you the unemployment office gave you a job interview, and they did. They gave me one to go to the Syracuse Chamber of Commerce to be the head of public relations. I kept going through the process not wanting to get the job because I'd been accepted to go to grad school at Missouri on the GI Bill. And I did everything I could not to get the job. And I finally got down to the final – there were two people left. And I told him – I said, look, I really don't want this job. I told him why. And he says, well, it's interesting because the president of the Chamber of Commerce looked at the application. He runs the local NBC station, and he'd like to hire you as a reporter. So that was my first job in journalism.
And then you wind up going to Columbia and not Missouri.
I did. By that point, I thought that the place I should go was Columbia because I was interested in making some contacts in New York. I was interested in going into the reporting, becoming a network correspondent. And I thought that Columbia, and particularly being in New York City, would – and they had a lot of faculty that were former network people – that it would help me. And it turned out to be right. By that point, I'd already had an undergraduate degree, worked for Stars and Stripes, done three years in local news. And the Columbia School is more ethereal than some of the other journalism schools like Missouri and Indiana and Syracuse, which is much more hands-on. I felt like at that point I'd already had that training. I knew how to do that, and the value was less. But Columbia still had something to offer me.
What did that local television news experience get you? What did you learn from that?
Everything. How to write a story, how to edit a story, how to make deadlines, most important thing to learn. How to write for radio, how to write for television, how to cover City Hall, how to cover a courthouse. It's very hard for me to believe anybody can be a very good reporter at any time in their career if they haven't had that experience of covering local government at the lowest levels, city councils. It sets everything else up. You need to know how to go through public records. You just need to know how to do that. So I got a great deal out of it. And I told a couple of your students, my advice to them was to start small. Make your mistakes where there aren't many people to see them and learn how to do it and then go someplace else.
You mentioned you started at an NBC station, and yet you wind up at the CBS network.
Right.
How did that transpire?
Well, and I ended up working for – I worked for all three. I worked for NBC, ABC, and CBS affiliates. And strangely enough, when I was in Miami, I had interests from all three of the networks. And the first was – and the most serious was with NBC. And then I didn't get the job. And then I got approached by ABC, and I didn't get that job either. But everybody said, look, it's just a matter of time. Then I got the offer from CBS and a few weeks later and took it immediately because it was CBS and because Walter Cronkite was anchoring the evening news. And it was the best one of the best news organizations, not just television networks, but one of the best news organizations in the world at that time.
But CBS was heading into a time of turmoil because Walter Cronkite retired, I think, a year after you came on
board. Yeah, a couple of years afterwards. But then Dan Rather had really a very good run, a long run, which people tend to forget. It was a time when Howard Stringer, Sir Howard Stringer, was the executive producer at the Evening News, and it was a great, great broadcast. And then I really enjoyed my time there, especially the 3 years that I spent in London as a foreign correspondent.
You actually had two stints, I guess, that would qualify as foreign correspondent. The first one was Latin America. Was it a challenge to learn foreign correspondence on the run?
It was a little bit. My first foreign assignment was El Salvador, which was a nasty little war. And I didn't really speak much Spanish, a little teeny tiny bit. But it was fun. I had been – that experience, because of Vietnam, didn't seem that foreign to me. It felt like I've done this before. I haven't done it for television, but I've done it for print, and I can manage it. So it's always been sort of a mixing and matching the skills that you pick up along the way, even today.
In London, you covered a number of stories concerned with terrorism. What kind of special challenges did those stories present you?
Well, it was in some ways the world's first experience with it. You had radical elements within the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO. You had people like Abu Nidal, which is a name that I'm sure probably many people don't realize at all, remember now at all. People who were hijacking cruise ships, people who were going into the, in the case of Abu Nidal, the Roman Vienna airports and opening up on innocent people with machine gun fire. But it was still very far removed from America. It was a European phenomenon. And, of course, there was we were just starting to come to grips with it. Gaddafi. Just the very early stages of it. It wasn't like it was dangerous covering it, although I was in the airport at Munich when a bomb went off upstairs, killed three or four people. It was down at the rental car station. But it was you were constantly trying to figure out the players, very small groups, mostly breakaway people who were living underground with very small numbers of people. It's not like today where you have fighters from many nations in Afghanistan. It's much different.
Later on, there was some discussion that broadcasters offered to the terrorists a kind of megaphone because they covered these incidents. Did those kinds of concerns occur to you at the time?
No, because I don't think you could ignore somebody hijacking a cruise ship and throwing people overboard or hijacking airplanes or shooting up airports. Those are just the kinds of things you can't ignore if you're a journalist. So it didn't – there was some discussions, some serious discussions about whether, given the opportunity, we should sit down and interview some of these people. There were always sort of ethical questions about how far we were going to go down that line. We went to the Bekaa Valley in Syria and interviewed terrorist leaders. That was a little – that was controversial. But at the time, those people didn't represent a direct threat to the United States.
When you were in the London Bureau, there were quite a few correspondents. Sheila McVicker, your colleague in CBS in London, told me recently they're down to four people. Does the drop in the number of people overseas reporting international news for U.S. media concern you?
It does, but it's a fact of life. At the time, we only had three people in London at the time, but there was also a correspondent in Paris and a correspondent in Rome and a correspondent in Bonn. And eventually, those bureaus have been closed, and all that whole operation has been consolidated in London. So the number of I think the fact that we don't have a correspondent in France is unfortunate, because French is an important language and that helps you a great deal covering certain parts of the world. But there's nothing really you could do about it. The economics of the business are changing so much that you can bemoan it, but you just have to work harder and in terms of covering the news. But I think now more than ever, people are relying on relationships with people like companies like the BBC to buy the material, to buy footage, and to fly off and supplement that footage on short notice. It's not the ideal way of operating, but it's better than nothing. And I think you can make the argument that there is more foreign news coverage now than there was when I was in London back in 1983, 84, and 85, simply because of the cable channels, the internet, and the growth of outlets like NPR, which talk and discuss about it. So I think there's actually more foreign coverage than there's ever been before, even though the networks aren't really involved in doing very much of it.
In the mid-'80s, you went first to West 57th Street and then to 60 Minutes.
Right.
Is there something about the long form, the feature form of journalism that appeals to you more than day-to-day breaking news journalism?
Well, there was at the time. By the time I got to West 57th and by the time my tour in London was ending, I was really longing for the opportunity to do something longer than 2 minutes. I felt like it was Scrimshaw, you know, drawing an elaborate sketch on a whale tooth. And I was interested. I'd done a number of stories for CBS Sunday Morning and really enjoyed it and liked it. And West 57th presented me with the best opportunity. And I also believed that if I went there and did well, that it could lead to a job at 60 Minutes, which it did.
What was your first 60 Minutes story?
A story I did with Jeff Fager, who is now the executive producer of 60 Minutes and my boss, on a woman named Lorraine Day, who was an orthopedic surgeon, I think the head of orthopedic surgery at a big San Francisco hospital, who was complaining about lack of care and lack of protection of orthopedic surgeons from AIDS patients because of the fact that you were cutting in many cases, using saws to operate. And she had started going into the operating room wearing a shield, a face shield, because she was concerned about possible blood splatter. And a lot of the precautions that are now routine in everything from dentist's office to the surgeries. And she was a pretty strong advocate and a very attractive and articulate woman, and saying some things that at the time were pretty controversial and now seem to be not hysterical but common sense.
You mentioned Jeff Fager, but you actually started under Don Hewitt, whose tenure at CBS goes back to Edward R. Murrow.
Yep.
What was he like to work under?
The greatest. One of the things that I've been blessed with, and one of the things that has had a huge impact on my career, is that I've had an opportunity to work with some really great people, from Howard Stringer to Fred Friendly when I was at Columbia, to Andy Lack at West 57th, and finally with Don, who is an impresario. It was an impresario at Television News, one of the best journalists I have ever seen. Had incredible instincts, and could tell instantly what was the crux of the story, and really changed television journalism in all sorts of different ways. But incredibly smart, a great boss. Who always gave a tremendous amount of credit to everyone involved in the stories. And he could be a tough customer, but he was a legend.
How has 60 Minutes changed since his departure?
I think if you watched it week to week, you wouldn't notice much. I think the way the news is reported, or the way the stories are reported, the values that we have in terms of production, the way the show's edited, haven't changed much. We've updated the look a little bit. We've got a camera now that actually moves in the studio shots, as opposed to one that just sort of set there on one. We've entered the 21st century in terms of graphics and whatnot, and even gone to high def, which is not a small thing. Requires a lot of technical adjustments. But Jeff is a little more structured. He is much more proactive in terms of suggesting or assigning stories to producers and correspondents. He's much more concerned about that there's a good balance or mix of the stories that are in the show. And Don used to be not care so much about that. He let the correspondents run their own teams, and he looked up at the board every week and picked the three best stories and put them on, at least towards the end. And I think that it's become a more watchable broadcast, and also I think that there's been a huge emphasis this year on breaking news, and there has been so much of it. There has not been another news year like this since 2001.
There's also been a change in generation in reporters, the passing of Ed Bradley, Mike Wallace into retirement, Morley Safer not on very much anymore. What does that, in your view, make a difference in the type of program that 60 Minutes is?
I would have said yes to that a year ago. I'm not sure I would now. I think to lose Ed Bradley was a huge loss. And as you notice, we have not really replaced him because there's nobody out there like Ed Bradley. And we have gone slow on that. I'm surprised that there was not more of a drop-off when Mike started cutting back and finally went into retirement. But we were talking earlier about how quickly time passes. And, Mike was on that broadcast for an awful long time and will forever be associated with the show. But at some point, people just sort of, I think, felt that it was time for Mike to retire. And the other thing is that the show was always an ensemble, always. And I never felt that when I was my first 15 years on the show that I was working on Mike Wallace's show. I felt that I was working on a show that had Mike Wallace and Morley Safer and Ed Bradley, and that all of those people were incredibly good, and that if it had just been Mike Wallace or just been Ed Bradley, the show wouldn't have been nearly as successful. I think that we still have some work to do in terms of finding. We right now just have three full-time correspondents, myself, Leslie, Stahl, Scott Pelley. Morley's doing halftime. Bob Simon is still somewhere between full-time and halftime. And I think there is a feeling that we need to find the right people, but they don't come up all that often. You have to kind of catch them in the on the right in moment in their contract when they're between jobs.
It's time to pause here and turn to some music that we're asking you to select. Can you tell us what you're selecting and why?
Something from Coldplay. because that's what I'm listening to right now.
That was music from Coldplay, chosen by our guest today, CBS correspondent Steve Croft. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU.
Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com.
Steve, your name is intimately associated with two Democratic presidential candidates. Bill Clinton, for a famous interview in which the future president denied he had an affair with Jennifer Flowers, and more recently with Barack Obama, from early in his campaign to early in his presidency. Which are you more proud of?
I'm proud of my association with both of them. I think that people ask me all the time, what's your favorite story? And the interview that I did with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, then the governor and first lady of Arkansas on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, was one of the best interviews that I've done. It was very early in my career when I hadn't developed a lot of my interview skills, but it was a unique situation where Governor Clinton said he wanted to talk about this once to the most to the largest audience possible, and then be able to say, I talked about this on 60 Minutes and I'm not going to talk about it anymore, which put a tremendous amount of pressure on me as the reporter to make sure that every avenue of escape was sealed off. So I spent a lot of time asking follow-up questions, and I was aware of the fact that he had picked up the sobriquet with Slick Willie. So I knew that he was very good at avoiding, and my job, I felt, was to protect the record, to not give him an opportunity to get away or leave any question unanswered about Jennifer Flowers, which I did. And the other thing about it was that it was the first time most of the country had ever seen Hillary Clinton. And she was so good and so strong that many people came back and said, you know, we should be electing her president. So it was Hillary's coming out party, and Bill Clinton did a great job. And I think it was really a significant reason why he won. I think people liked him after the interview and thought he was very smart. It was later then that it was discovered that, of course, he had lied during the interview about Jennifer Flowers, which he acknowledged that he'd had a relationship with her while he was testifying during, I think, the Paula Jones thing. I have a tremendous amount of respect for both of them, but in his memoir, President Clinton said he wanted to punch me in the face.
As I understand others have wanted.
Right. I told a reporter who asked me about it, I said he's going to have to get to the end of a very long line.
Did you suspect that Clinton was lying?
I suspected that he wasn't telling the entire truth, but his whole argument was, look, this is my business. This is personal stuff between myself and my wife. We shouldn't be talking about that. And I think that sort of carried the day, and I think he would have been fine, and I admire that point. And I think that it certainly has changed my interest. I have no interest in ever doing another one of those interviews in which I have to ask a candidate about his personal life or a president about his personal life. I thought that he handled it incredibly well, but I wouldn't want to do it again.
How did you happen to get assigned to that interview? Because I would have thought, knowing what we know about Clinton, Ed Bradley perhaps would have been a natural.
Because I had very good contacts with a good friend who was on working for Ron Brown, the Democratic National Committee, and was very close to Harold Ickes, who was a top Clinton advisor. And we thought that the interview was going to run the previous Thursday, and we thought it was going to be on Nightline. And what happened was that for one reason or another, they didn't do it. I think the weather was bad in New Hampshire. I think there was also an execution in scheduled in the state of Arkansas. I didn't want to be on television while that was going on at 11 o'clock at night. And the next available time was the Sunday broadcast with a big audience. And it just so happened that we had the Super Bowl that night, and we were able to give him some time after the Super Bowl, which was a pretty good lead-in. And I got the call from the committee saying, you know, well, are you interested in doing this? Because they didn't do Nightline. And I said, absolutely. And I called Don Hewitt and said, whatever. But it was my friend. It was a personal contact.
The connection with Obama, I think, is also a somewhat personal thing going back to the beginning of his campaign, is it not?
Right. His campaign had already gotten a lot of attention. He was a bit of a phenomenon. He'd been on the cover of Time and Newsweek. But we went out and did a long piece on him before he declared, starting a couple of weeks before, and followed him around, and ended up with his speech announcing his candidacy. And we developed a rapport in part because there was nobody around him. In those days, it was just David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs, and that was pretty much it. David Plouffe, Axelrod's partner. And so you could spend time with him. You rode in the car with him. There was nobody there from, event to event. And it was you got to know him a little bit. And the next time we did a story, I did it. And it's just kind of continued.
But that actually does raise this interesting question. How do you maintain a balance between ensuring continued access and asking the really tough questions?
I think it's always a challenge. I don't think this president and most presidents are – I don't think the challenge is asking tough questions. I think it's knowing how to ask the tough questions. And too often people are concerned. They think it's a tough question if you raise your voice or if you jab at somebody or you become aggressive or you say you didn't answer the question or let me ask the question again. That's just a perception on the part of people who write about television. You can ask very tough questions without, with a smile on your face and get a much better answer than you would by being aggressive. But having said that, I feel that I could ask this president a tough question as long as I gave him an opportunity to answer it. And he will do his best to answer it. But it's something you have to constantly watch for. And I watch for it by trying to always have people working on the story, a couple of people working on the story who I know are going to come up with the tough question to ask. And when we started doing – I began the research for this last interview. I asked a couple of associate producers and producers who are working with me on the story, Frank Devine and Michael Radetzky, and their associate producers to give me – all the articles that contain criticisms of Obama, op-ed page pieces, editorials, everything. So I felt like I was not missing anything.
I think I read on one occasion when you went to Obama's house in Chicago, you were met by one of his daughters.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the notion of covering a president's family? Is that fair game?
Yeah, I think it depends. In what way? What do you mean by covering them? You haven't seen that much of it, except in public situations, getting on helicopters. They've kept the kids pretty much in the background.
How in general do you go about preparing for a story? I know that's a general question, but if you're given story X, how do you think about it?
Well, chances are I'm not given story X. Chances are that one of my producers or myself has come up with the idea of doing story X. And I have each of the correspondents at 60 Minutes has staff of producers and associate producers. I have 8 people that work with me and at any given time. And most of them work exclusively with me. And what I will do, we'll kick around stories and I'll decide, ultimately make the decision whether we want to do them. But I wouldn't impose a story on a producer who didn't want to do it because they're going to be working with it longer than I am. And I reserve the right to refuse a story I don't want to do. So we agree on the story. And once we agree on the story, then we have a group. Then the associate producer and the producer will go out and start pulling research, start making phone calls, read everything that's been written on the subject or on peripheral subjects. They'll come up with a list of people to talk to. They'll make calls. And we'll sort of cast the story and report the story without cameras before we ever start shooting any of the interviews. Most of the time we pre-interviewed people, we have sort of an idea what they're going to say, although they never say the same thing on camera that they do when you're talking to them off camera. And then we'll start shooting. And I will by that time have read a very thick research book. And we'll have read the notes on the pre-interview. Sometimes you don't have a pre-interview. Sometimes if it's a confrontational interview, you don't want to – you'll only get one shot at them. So then I'll go out and do the interviews. Then I'll come back and I'll move on to another story. The producers will take that material. They'll go in the edit room. They'll come up with a cut. They'll do a rough cut. They'll come back to me and give me a rough cut. Then I'll start restructuring it and rewriting it for air. Sometimes we may cut the story two or three different times, two or three different ways to see which plays best.
What does it take to be successful at 60 Minutes?
Well, I have to tell you, it's not an easy place to work. And I would say that the thing that I'm proudest about is the fact that I have survived. Because it was a pretty tough and intimidating place to work with when I started out with Mike and Morley and Ed and Harry Reasoner. Those were some pretty talented people and had been doing it for a long time. And you were, no matter how good you thought you were, and I thought at the time that I was pretty good, I still had a lot to learn. So you have to be willing to learn from the people that are around you, and it is a different – the job is different, much different than the job I had on at the Evening News. There's a little more what I would call performance involved. You have to really refine your interview skills. You have to learn how to strategize. You have to learn how to set up the money question. Yeah, all these little subtle things you never had to worry about when you were doing a 2-minute piece from the Evening News. And it's a very competitive place. And it was set up by Don to be competitive with the five producers, with their own five correspondents, with their own staffs. And the most difficult thing, we compete against each other more than we compete against anybody outside the building for stories. So it's you have to be tough. You have to be tough. You have to have a thick skin, and you have to be willing to learn the things that you don't know.
One part of 60 Minutes has been the celebrity interviews. What's been your favorite celebrity interview?
Clint Eastwood, by far.
Why?
Because I went into it not thinking a great deal about Clint Eastwood one way or the other. I had seen some interviews and he had done very few television interviews at that time. And the ones I'd seen, I didn't think were particularly good. He's not loquacious. He's a man of few words. I was never a big fan of the Dirty Harry movies. And I thought that he was probably, dyed-in-the-wool California Republican. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I thought that he was sort of one-dimensional, and in fact, he's anything but one-dimensional. He's a very, very talented person, very sensitive person. Very good, accomplished jazz musician that writes the scores for his own movies. Very smart businessman in terms of real estate and that some of the deals that he's made out there over the years. And he's just a very decent person. We got along very well.
What story would you like to have a do-over on?
Boy, I don't think about that. I'm sure there are some, but I don't want to embarrass anybody by by listing them. But there are a few. There have been a few stories that I just wouldn't have rather have not done, simply because the person that we ended up interviewing wasn't very good, or the story that we thought was there when we began shooting it turned out not to be nearly as good a story as we thought because of information we turned up during the course of doing the story. And that happens all the time. Sometimes they get better. Sometimes they get worse, which is why we try not to make that mistake by doing as much reporting on it as we can before we actually commit resources to go out and turn it into television. But occasionally you'll make mistakes and you'll end up with one that you thought maybe you shouldn't have done. But I haven't felt that way in a while. And I think that's important. You don't want to do that. You want to be sure. There's been stories that I probably should have done. More of those that somebody came to me with and I said, I'm not interested in that. That turned out to be great stories.
Have you ever been in danger or been arrested by the police or anything like that?
I've certainly been in danger in Central America and in Beirut back during the 80s. And a few other places. I've been shot at it on three continents. I've been detained. Let's put it that way. I've never been booked and put in a jail cell, but I have been taken to the police station and detained a number of times and had lots of altercations with security people and police officers that occasionally result in getting kicked or bumped or bruised. And taken down to the station a few times, but never locked up.
What do you do to relax?
My wife would say not much. I play golf.
That's right. You have this Mad Anthony's red coat from the fundraiser at Fort Wayne, as I
recall. I do. Boy, you know everything. You've done your research. And that's, I think, the greatest. We have a situation where it's very unique in today's world, where the entire 60 Minutes operation shuts down during the month of July, and we all go away at the same time, confident that nothing much in the world is going to happen during the month of July. And it's a wonderful sort of European tradition, and because you really have the ability to relax without anybody from work calling you. And I try and take a couple of weeks vacation during the year at Christmas time and maybe a week in the spring if I can get away. But the rest of the time, you're pretty busy. You're pretty busy. I have a house out in Long Island that my wife and I and my son go to every weekend. We can. And it's nice being out of the city and you have the ability to relax. I like to watch basketball. I mean, that's one addiction that I brought from Indiana to the east. And during July, I like to play golf and waste time.
Some thoughts about some of the people that you've worked with. Ed Bradley.
Great human being. Terrific interviewer. Wonderful perspective on life. Not a workaholic. Somebody who took time to stop and smell the roses. Very good journalist, great instincts, particularly in front of the camera when the camera was rolling, and just a delightful human being.
Dan Rather.
Don't really know Dan very well. Never worked with him at 60 Minutes. When 60 Minutes 2 was an operation, Dan's still had the day job, which at CBS is physically removed from where 60 Minutes is. When I was working for his broadcast, I was either in Dallas or Miami or London. And when I came back, I went to work for the primetime section and really didn't have much to do with it. So he's a very charming man. I have an incredible amount of respect for his journalistic talents in terms of being an anchorman, in terms of getting on the air and being able to report a story live while it's going on. I don't think there was anybody ever better at it than Dan. But I don't know a lot about him other than we have a friendly relationship.
Morley Safer.
Great friend. great friend, as important in my mind to the success of 60 Minutes as Mike was, in a different sort of way, because Mike was sort of the anti-hero. And Morley was, when he came along, other than Charles Collingwood, there had never really been anybody on television like him who could write and really well and could get away with wearing maybe an ascot and just had a sense of style and savoir-faire that that made a huge contribution to television at 60 Minutes.
Kind of modern-day Charles Collingwood, perhaps.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Did you ever talk about Morley Safer about Vietnam, since some of his most famous reporting came from there?
I have. I told him a story. It's a funny story. The first time I ever heard the name Morley Safer was – it must have been in 1971, and this is years after he had the – he had filmed the GIs of the Marines burning down Vietnamese houses. I was working at the information office of the 25th Infantry Division, and they had said that Morley Safer was coming through to do a documentary on Vietnam. This would have been about 1971. And I've never seen a group of people more nervous in their entire life. We had a big meeting, and the general staff was terrified, and it was like you were preparing for some sort of an all-out attack. So Morley got a big kick out of that when I told him.
Andy Rooney.
A great journalist. Most people don't remember him for that. Now he is sort of a commentator, a cranky old man, but always a great journalist and also revolutionary in many ways with the documentaries that he did with Harry Reasoner, and which he wrote them all. And with the Mr. Rooney documentaries he did at CBS before he came to 60 Minutes. Tremendous wit, but the thing that has made him so good over the years are his insights and his ability to know, to absorb information. Great reporter.
Mike Wallace.
In my mind, the best. Better than Cronkite. More versatile than Cronkite in terms of being a lasting figure. Always lacked a little confidence because he had not been trained as a journalist and managed somehow to go all the way into his 90s without realizing that there's never been a better interviewer and there's never been anybody more successful in terms of getting information out of people. Very helpful, very supportive to my career. And was really, along with, I think, the person that brought me to Don Hewitt's attention. I have a tremendous – he could be tough. You didn't want to go and compete against him for a story. A big mistake. He tried really hard to get the Clinton interview away from me, and Don intervened. But he was just incredibly competitive and driven. But a very gracious, charming man.
That brings us to the conclusion of this conversation. Our guest today has been CBS correspondent for 60 Minutes, Steve Croft. Steve, thanks for visiting with us.
Owen, thank you.
To our listeners, we're pleased you joined us. For WFIU, I'm Owen Johnson.
Was a long and dark December. From the rooftops I remember there was snow, white snow. Clearly I remember from the windows they were watching while we froze down below. When the peace is
The program you have just heard was recorded in March of 2009. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Production support for Profiles comes from Smithville, a locally owned business serving central and southern Indiana since 1922, with residential and business internet, voice, and security services. Smithville, local pride, global technology. Information at smithville.net. And the Funeral Chapel of Bloomington, providing funeral and crematory arrangement services for the chapel, church, and graveside. The Funeral Chapel, to honor and commemorate. 333-4400 or online at pdcfuneralchapel.com. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. Information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website, wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.